Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Kevin McCrory in for Marty Moscowane. Facebook, Google, Apple, Amazon. These tech giants have become so intrinsically tied up with American life that for many of us, it's hard to imagine a day without them. They know what we like, what we buy, what we do. And they've used our data to grow extremely powerful and profitable, so much so that some say they've become monopolies too easily able to quash the competition.
We need to ensure the antitrust laws first written more than a century ago work in the digital age. When these laws were written, the monopolists were men named Rockefeller and Carnegie. Their control of the marketplace allowed them to do whatever it took to crush independent businesses and expand their own power. Well, the names have changed, but the story is the same. Today, the men are named Zuckerberg, Cook, Pichai, and Bezos. Once again, their control of the marketplace allows them to do whatever it takes to crush independent business and expand their own power. This must end.
That was Rep. David Cicilline, the chairman of the Antitrust Subcommittee, during a recent hearing in Congress where the CEOs of those four corporations testified before lawmakers. Not only are these companies powerful, they're extremely influential. And with social media, the conversation gets especially messy, forcing questions about free speech, censorship, conspiracy theories, political influence, and foreign interference. On this Radio Times, Big Tech in 2020. Where are we? Where are we going? We have three guests this hour. The first half of the show will be with David Dayan. He's the executive editor of The American Prospect and has a new book out called Monopolized: Life in the Age of Corporate Power. And later, we'll have Kathleen Hall Davidson, a communications professor at Penn and the co-founder of FactCheck.org. Joshua Tucker will also join us. He's the co-director of NYU's Center for Social Media and Politics. David Dayan, we're starting with you. You covered that hearing extensively. What did we learn when these CEOs faced tough questions under oath?
I think we learned quite a lot. The Antitrust Subcommittee was very committed, and this was the culmination of a year-long investigation. So they had quite a voluminous amount of primary evidence at their disposal, and the CEOs essentially agreed or admitted to things that could be seen in many contexts as violations of antitrust law, particularly around their scooping up rivals to increase their market position, as well as unfair play or what could be seen as that on their platforms to muscle out competition.
Could you get into the specifics a little bit more there? Like, what would the average person understand as far as what that behavior would mean? What would that look like?
Sure. So, one of the easier ones to understand is Facebook's acquisition of Instagram in 2012. The committee had primary documents from Mark Zuckerberg, as well as the CFO of Facebook, saying that Instagram was a threat to their business and that they would go into destroy mode if they were unable to acquire Instagram. In fact, at the time, Facebook created a clone of Instagram, essentially Instagram's product, only tailored for Facebook, so that Facebook's many times multiple amount of users could actually see and use that tool, and basically put it to Instagram that we're either going to copy you or we're going to acquire you, and either way, we're going to bring you into our influence, and you'll either be no more as an organization or you'll be part of us. And in fact, that's what happened.
I guess some might push back on that and say, Facebook is this example of this kind of American dream business. It started in a college dorm and grew to these epic proportions. And yes, it's big and yes, it's powerful, but isn't that just a critique of them for being successful?
Well, you could see the success at the outset, but then when you leverage your market position to make sure that competition is strangled before it can and become a choice that users can select, that's when it becomes an anti-competitive situation. And we have laws like the Sherman Antitrust Act that say that no one may seek to acquire a monopoly. And, you know, I would say that Facebook's actions, not just with Instagram, but in the acquisition of WhatsApp, in the cloning of Snapchat. Snapchat refused to be acquired by Facebook, and so Facebook made a knockoff called Instagram Stories and Facebook Stories. And in what they do subsequently, Facebook apparently hired and this Israeli company called Onavo to do data mining on the phones of teenagers to see what apps they were downloading so they could have an early warning system to see what was gaining traction and then, you know, roll out this strategy of either copying them or acquiring them.
And that just happened this week too, right? With Instagram, which, like you say, is owned by Facebook, had its copy of essentially TikTok out with Reels, right?
That's correct. Yeah. Reels is essentially the same version of TikTok. TikTok is in trouble with the president because its parent company is Chinese. And TikTok has been the Trump administration said that they must divest of TikTok within 45 days. And so this is a difficult time for an app that has gotten a lot of traction. A lot of younger people really like that tool. And so here comes Facebook rolling out a version of TikTok to its billion plus users. In an effort to capitalize on this tumult at this rival company.
Antitrust laws in general, as they're often understood, exist to protect consumers. And I guess some could argue that consumers have chosen this path, right? There's other options out there for search, for social media, for cell phones. Many people just really prefer Google and Facebook and Apple. And to that point, I want to play a clip of Apple CEO Tim Cook at that recent congressional hearing.
When customers consistently give iPhone a 99% satisfaction rating, that's the message they're sending about the user experience. But we also know that customers have a lot of choices and that our products face fierce competition. Companies like Samsung, LG, Huawei, and Google have built successful businesses with different approaches. We're okay with that. Our goal is the best, not the most. In fact, we don't have a dominant share in any market or in any product category where we do business.
David Day, and your response to that?
Well, I mean, a lot of this depends on how you define the market. I mean, there was some comical ways in which the CEOs did that at the hearing. Facebook defined their market as communication and interaction with other people, like the phone was a competitor to Facebook. Amazon similarly said they were 1% of all retail, and that was making a distinction between Amazon and the entire economic transactions that you can do, when in fact half of all economic transactions online e-commerce deals begin at Amazon. So it depends on how you define this market, first of all. The second thing I would say is that customer satisfaction is not a substitute for following the antitrust laws. I mean, the actions that I described with Facebook, which are replicable, Apple acquires like a company every week. Amazon has acquired numerous companies and has dropped their prices significantly to, in a predatory way, muscle out their competition like they did with diapers.com. These are anti-competitive actions. And, you know, it just because people seem to like the product doesn't really take away from that.
Speaking of small businesses, the pandemic that we're all going through has been awful for many of these in-person businesses. Turns out it's been pretty gangbusters for big tech. Facebook's revenue grew 10% in the quarter. Amazon saw a huge surge in people buying things through its website. Prime accounts are up. As Zoom and Netflix are dominating the market, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft's cloud services are benefiting. What do you think the effect of this is on the economy writ large?
Well, the pandemic is absolutely accelerating the power and market of big tech. They all released earnings numbers the day after the hearing, those four big companies. And those four companies received $206 billion in revenue just in the second quarter at a time when the U.S. economy was collapsing. So The pandemic is accelerating a trend that we've seen over the last 40 years of more and more power in the economy and in our democracy, I would say, put into the hands of fewer and fewer people. And that has dangerous implications for wages. It has dangerous implications for small businesses and entrepreneurs and innovation, as we heard about in the hearing. It has dangers across a whole host of areas within our economy, and usually economic power converts into political power. And so there are dangers for our politics as well.
You know, head of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, might say, look, like the fact that we exist and we've built all this infrastructure has allowed so many more small businesses to come into being and to be able to sell through our marketplace. And so, yeah, you know, we compete with people, but at the same time, we've provided a lot of opportunities. Your thoughts on that?
I would say Amazon destroys as many jobs and businesses as they create in brick and mortar retail and elsewhere. Furthermore, the jobs that are created by Amazon come under essentially Amazon's private law, private government, the rules by which third-party sellers on the Amazon marketplace must follow. This is the subject of a chapter in my book, Monopolized. They have to follow all these sort of arcane rules. There was testimony in the hearing that the percentage of an average sale that now goes from a third-party seller to Amazon has increased over the last few years from 19% to 30%, and seemingly Amazon is tying some products together, saying if you actually want to get noticed on our website, you have to use our logistics services and our shipping services, which is a violation of antitrust law, tying behavior, saying that you can't get a certain benefit unless you also purchase this other product from us, could be construed as a violation. So I would say that the problem is control there and power. Amazon has this level of control over the third-party sellers who have pretty much nowhere else to go to sell their products. They might have been, operating businesses in brick and mortar storefronts previously, or selling out of their garage. Now they're finding a way to get ahead on Amazon, and they are subject to the whims of this giant corporation, sometimes suspended for no reason, having to go through these layers of Byzantine appeals, which eventually end, I've been told, at businesses being told by consultants that they have to write an email to Jeff Bezos in order to get relief and get out of suspension. So
coming up on a break here, David, we'll be right back with David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect. He writes about the role of big tech in our lives and in the economy. We'll hear more with him after a short break. And we want to hear from you. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Leave us a note on Facebook and Twitter @WHYY Radio Times, or call us 1-888-477-9499. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Kevin McCrory, in for Marty Moskowin. We're speaking with David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect, about the role of big tech in our lives and in the economy. And we want to hear from you. Email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. Leave us a note on Facebook and Twitter, @WHYY Radio Times, or call us, 1-888-477-9499. David, back to you. I'm just curious, if this behavior is illegal, why isn't the U.S. government interceding?
That's the million-dollar question. The antitrust authorities, the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission, had all of the information that the House Antitrust Subcommittee had and displayed at this hearing, and had every ability to deny the Facebook-Instagram merger, for example, or cite Amazon for its various predatory practices, or Google, or what have you. And they chose not to do so. And there's sort of a long tradition over the last 40 years of a real laissez-faire approach to antitrust law. And it has created this situation of concentration within our economy. So I think the hearing was really a wake-up call to these agencies that they have ultimately failed.
So what do you expect will actually come out of this hearing then? David Dana, are you there?
Well, the hearing is going to create. Yeah, I'm here. Hello.
Oh, yes. Sorry, you're good.
Yes. The hearing is going to create a report. This was the culmination of, as I said, of a year-long investigation. And that report is going to identify a few things. Number one, what to do about these tech giants. Number two, what the antitrust authorities, these agencies, can do with their existing authority. And number three, what legislative changes, if any, need to be made. And so the next administration, the next Congress, can look at that information, the culmination of this very long and detailed investigation and detailed recommendations, and decide, you know, what needs to be done. And we, the public, can hold the next Congress and the next administration to that standard.
What would be ideal to you, like breaking these corporations up? Is there a need to treat big tech as a public utility? How would that work for a company like Amazon or Google?
Yeah, I mean, any of those things are possible. You could see a structural separation. For example, Amazon cannot sell its own products on the same marketplace that it has third-party sellers coming into, and in effect competing on the playing field where they are the umpire. Google, in the same way, you could divorce their search tool with their advertising technology, the back end, so that they're not preferring their own content in that form. There are a number of ways, both antitrust, which would be around mergers and divestitures and breakups, and also anti-monopoly policy, which would be more the public utility style regulation that you were getting at. I think you're going to need a combination of all of these things to bring these organizations into balance.
Just to give an analogy and an example off of the Amazon example you were just describing, you know, when I go to the grocery store I see the cereal aisle, right? There's the Fruit Loops, and then there's the store brand knockoff version of the Fruit Loops. And
sure.
If I want to buy that version for a little bit cheaper, I do, and it feels like healthy competition. Isn't that essentially the same thing as what Amazon's doing?
It would be the same thing if also the store in which you went to also had perfect information and data about what you were buying at any one time, and showed you, instead of an aisle full of all these choices, showed you just the generic store brand at the top, and then had you walk about a mile in the other direction to get to the Fruit Loops. I mean, that's what Amazon does. They preference the products that make them the most money based on the data that they have personally of you, of your individual shopping behavior around that. And they use that data to devise their own products, and they use that data to show their own products to you in the buy box, which traditionally is the thing in which people click at far higher rates than any other product. So it's not a perfect choice, really. They're preferencing that choice for you.
Hmm. So what do you think the average person should do individually? Like, what behavior do you recommend people changing?
Well, I don't put a ton of stock into boycotts or personal responsibility, personal behavior. That's similar to saying that we should all change our light bulbs to fight global warming, which, you know, is something we could do and maybe should do, but it's not going to solve the problem. The problem needs to be solved at a state and federal level because it's simply too big for to expect every individual to make some individual choice to change the way in which they shop or behave. And also, these companies are too big. You can't get out of the way of using a Facebook or a Google or an Amazon. Even if you think you're not using them, they're tracking you around the web on other websites that you visit, for example. It's difficult to say, I'm just going to wall off my life away from big tech. That's not the way that our economy works these days. You have to interact with these tools. And so it's incumbent upon our lawmakers to ensure that not just we're protected as consumers, but that we're protected as workers, as small businesses, and as citizens.
Before we let you go, David, I want to have you expand a little bit on TikTok. You referenced that earlier. There's been this, you know, national conversation all of a sudden about this app that was relatively unknown a few months ago. What is going on there, and why should America care?
Well, you know, as I said, TikTok has a Chinese parent company, and the idea here is that they can, you know, use this popular tool of TikTok to acquire data and use it, you know, potentially for national security reasons. My feeling is that if the Chinese government wants data, they can certainly get it from data brokers and harvesters and all sorts of ways. They don't really need TikTok to do that. So I think the rhetoric here is a little bit overheated. But what it does show is that all of these tools need to be regulated in terms of data privacy for a variety of reasons. And it's certainly not just TikTok that is collecting data that can potentially use it to malign ends. I mean, we had an election that was, you know, by all accounts tampered with. And that was done mostly through Facebook, right? I mean, and that's how that data was collected and, you know, disinformation thrown at people. So I don't think that TikTok necessarily represents this overwhelming and singular national security threat. I think that the problem lies in sort of the nature of that entire all of social media.
Well, David Dayne, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
All right. Thank you.
That was David Dayne, executive editor of The American Prospect. We've been talking this hour about the outsized power that big tech corporations have. Let's pivot now to talk about social media and the role that content plays in our lives and in our democracy, specifically in terms of information and misinformation. We have two guests now joining us. Kathleen Hall Jamieson is a communications professor at the University of Pennsylvania and the co-founder of FactCheck.org. Great to have you, Kathleen.
Hi.
And I apologize, I did say your name, Davidson, instead of Jamieson at the top of the show. Sorry about that.
No problem.
Joshua Tucker is co-director of NYU's Center for Social Media and Politics. Thanks for being here, Joshua.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
An interesting development in these past few months is that Google and Facebook both have been flagging and removing misleading information about coronavirus. Twitter has also flagged a few of President Trump's tweets for the same reason. It's barred the president's son from using the platform for 12 hours as a punishment. In June, Facebook said it would remove posts that incite violence or attempt to suppress voting, and that the company will label posts that violate its hate speech policies. Twitter has come out aggressively against accounts related to the conspiracy theory QAnon. Kathleen Hall Davidson, let's start with you. Is this censorship that will lead to a slippery slope, or responsible stewardship of powerful online platforms?
It's somewhere in between. These are difficult categories, and particularly when you're dealing with political speech, problematic and enforcement. The critical thing with all of this is having bright lines that, when crossed by anyone, are going to be flagged in the same way.
What bright lines do you see? How would you?
Any appeals to violence, any blatant information that would yield health care outcomes that are problematic, any direct efforts to suppress the vote.
The Trump era seems to have really tested these questions because the president's preferred communications tool has been Twitter, right? And posts go straight to the public without context or scrutiny by journalists. Joshua Tucker, can you talk about how the president uses social media to drive the conversation?
Sure. I mean, Twitter in particular, but social media generally, gives a tool to political elites to be able to speak in a kind of unmediated manner to the public. So the first way that it can work is that you can speak directly to your followers on social media without having to worry about how it's being interpreted by reporters, as we had to do in the sort of pre-social media era, where you'd have to go through a press conference and wonder what was going to be on the news, what was going to be in the news story. But for a select few number of politicians, like at President Trump, who's probably the ultimate epitome of this, it also gives you the power to drive what the media is going to be talking about. And I think that's what Trump has whether it's deliberate or inadvertent, by his constant staccato of these all these different tweets on all these different subjects coming out, he has the ability to get the attention of the media on what he wants the media to be thinking about. Now, sometimes he gets in his own way because he goes off to another topic so quickly right thereafter. But this is a sort of new tool for presidents in the modern kind of social media age. The number of politicians who can do this is an interesting question, but certainly at the highest level of state, and certainly someone who is as prolific on Twitter as President Trump, this is something they can do. So it's both the direct impact of being able to speak directly to constituents, but it's also, and this is probably ultimately a much bigger deal, it's the ability to sort of shape the conversation and to do it in such rapid time without having to call a press conference, without having to go through all the normal channels that have happened previously.
So what do we make of a company like Twitter or Facebook flagging or removing a post made by a major politician?
Well, as you started off by asking this question, I mean, this is a very slippery slope that we have to think, you know, we want to think carefully about this. If you listen to Facebook in particular or Mark Zuckerberg, you will always hear this question about not wanting to be the arbiters of truth, a statement that they'll make over and over again. And the interesting thing about that is it can both be a very convenient excuse for Facebook, because as Professor Jameson said a moment ago, right, these are very difficult decisions that these platforms have to make about how they deal with regulating speech, and in particular, how they deal with regulating speech of politicians. So on the one hand, this can be taken as, well, it's very convenient for Facebook or Twitter to say they don't want to be the arbiters of truth because it gets them out of this difficult situation. On the other hand, it doesn't mean that it's actually not true that they don't want to be the arbiters of truth, right? We are talking here about particularly, and when we think about Facebook and when we think in particular about Google, YouTube, two absolutely enormous companies. This is big tech writ large, with Twitter not that far behind. And we're asking them to make decisions about what is going to be permissible in the public arena. So I think this gets you into, as you said, a very sort of slippery slope very quickly about this, right? About what the role of private, huge private, powerful private companies should be in regulating speech in the public sphere. That, I think, goes back to what Professor Jameson said about the ability to have these kind of bright lines that she mentioned, right, as one way to provide guidance to how you go about doing this. But I think it puts these companies in a very difficult situation because they want to be seen as being politically neutral, right? It is not advantageous for either of the platforms to be seen as helping one side of the political process or not, because they're going to have to deal with politicians from both sides of the political process, and they're going to have periods of time where one side is in power and has more influence than the other side has. So for the platforms, the goal is to sort of appear nonpartisan. But when you get into the question of having to take down speech from particular politicians, that becomes increasingly difficult to do.
Yeah, let's bring you back into the conversation, Kathleen Hull Jameson. You talk about these bright lines. You know, what if tomorrow Facebook is run by, you know, an extreme liberal, and a few days from now or a month from now it's run by an extreme conservative? Those bright lines are going to start to look different depending on a person's ideology or a corporation's ideology, I'd imagine.
Well, that's one of the reasons that we've got any concerns about political speech being fettered. If you go back to the history of radio, when we first began to talk about what should political access be for those leaders who need to speak to an electorate in order to reach them, in order to be elected, in order to be considered for election, what we saw in the early days of radio was the radio owners would bar access to any politician they disagreed with. That's part of the reason we have the FCC regulations about access to the airwaves. Now, the difference is the airwaves are publicly owned. These are private corporations. And so the same rules don't apply, but the same principle needs to in some important way. Who should we trust to deny us access to candidate speech? Now, at some point, when you've got unlimited amounts of money and you've got the bully pulpit, which is accessible to a president, the issue isn't so much can you get access, but what are the implications of denying some channels of access based on some bright lines. But if the lines are clear enough, you should be able across time to see that they are able to be enforced regardless of the ideology of the candidate or the partisan dispositions of those leading a company.
Hmm. A lot of the recent decision-making by Facebook and Twitter has been related to the coronavirus. Kathleen, could you talk about the misinformation that's been shared there and its influence?
Yeah, one of the concerns that we have is when you get public health at issue, you are now dealing with misinformation having immediate and dire consequences. And we are in a pandemic, which means that your bad health decisions based on misinformation can affect me, and mine can affect you as well. And we're able to affect substantially larger communities through actions that might be problematic. And so in the health domain, for example, the platforms have been blocking information that misleads about the measles vaccine and about the effects of the measles vaccine, the safety of the measles vaccine. I applaud those decisions, and if a political leader wants to put out that kind of information, censor him all you'd like. We do not want people to not take the measles vaccine when high levels of measles vaccination is protection for those who are immune compromised and can't be vaccinated, those who are under immunized, that is, the immunization just simply didn't take, as well as other people who are vulnerable in the population at large who can't yet be vaccinated, including very young children. You can't really advantageously vaccinate a child under the age of 1 year old. So when you take a look at something that's highly contagious, measles, coronavirus, less contagious but nonetheless contagious, there is a public health need that overrides concerns you have about blocking political access to speech or any access to speech on a platform. And the platforms have, in my judgment, acted very responsibly by blocking access to that kind of information.
One glaring example was the conspiracy film Plandemic. Joshua, can you talk a little bit about that film, what was wrong with it, and how fast its message spread on social media?
Well, I think, I mean, this is typical of what can happen on social media, which is that what distinguishes social media, I think, from prior aspects of communication is that in the past, you had communication that was slower, and it was also much more hierarchical. And there were ultimately in the press, there were professional journalists who were in charge at various stages in the process of deciding what was going to be spread out, whether it's the producer on a television news show, whether it's, as Professor Jamison was saying, you know, who's going to decide who's the guest on a radio show, whether it's an editor at a newspaper or the journalists themselves. Social media has changed this by dramatically reducing the barriers, what it costs to publish information, essentially. Now, most of that information that's published, if you put it out on your own Twitter account, you put it out on a Facebook post or something like that, most of that information is going to go nowhere. You'll see a few of
Joshua,
your friends.
Joshua, I'll have to cut you off there. We'll come back to your point after a break. You're listening to Joshua Tucker there, co-director of NYU's Center for Social Media and Politics. We're also with Kathleen Hall Jamison at University of Pennsylvania. We'll be back more right after this break. Leave us a note on Facebook or Twitter at WHYY. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Kevin McCrory, in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking with Kathleen Hall Jamison, communications professor at the University of Pennsylvania and the co-founder of FactCheck.org. Also has a recent book out, Cyber War, How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President. Also, we're with Joshua Tucker, co-director of NYU's Center for Social Media and Politics. We're talking about social media disinformation and its effect on the current pandemic and the 2020 election. And we want to hear from you. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Leave us a note on Facebook or Twitter at WHYY Radio Times, or call us at 1-888-477-9499. Joshua, before the break there, we were talking about the film Plandemic. You were telling us about essentially with social media, we're just in a different era with how fast things can spread without the typical gatekeepers that used to exist. Some say that's a good thing in some situations. In this situation, you say it's a bad thing.
Well, I mean, and that's the interesting thing about social media. When we begin to think big picture about social media's impact on democracy, right, this point about that it reduces the barriers to entry, right? Like social media makes it easier for people who don't have access to mainstream media to have their voices heard. That's because of this flattening of access to communication. It's because of this lack of gatekeepers, and it's because of the action, what you were describing about Plandemic, which is this idea about virality, that certain information can be spread incredibly quickly through the internet because of the speed at which these communications take place. Now, what's interesting about this is that this idea of reducing barriers to allow people who don't have access to mainstream media to have their voices heard, this is exactly the thing about social media that so excited pro-democracy activists around the world, not even a decade ago when social media sort of first burst on the scene, when we began to hear about this in terms of, say, the Arab Spring and the spread of democracy globally, is because in authoritarian regimes where you think about people who don't have access to mainstream media, that can be That can be people who have pro-democracy agendas. But when you go to a democratic system, when you think about people who don't have access to mainstream media, on the one hand, that may be very progressive voices. If you think about mainstream media as not wanting to, you know, be as open to very progressive voices, so you might think about Occupy Wall Street or the rise of Black Lives Matter online. But also, mainstream media has long excluded these kind of voices that are antithetical to democracy, these anti-systemic voices. And social media can help on both of these sides. Now, that brings us back to the question with Plandemic, which is you get into the situation where these same avenues that open these up for these political views that might previously have been done, you also don't have this gatekeeping on expertise, you don't have this gatekeeping on scientific knowledge. So you combine these and you get into these kinds of situations like you, where you found around Plandemic, where you have things that have the ability to be put forward without gatekeeping to spread quickly. And this is the same mechanism that many people would say, again, had, you know, helps bring voices into the democratic conversation, but it also can bring things that are threatening in this regard. And so that's what makes this a double-edged sword.
Mm. The larger fear here seems to be that we as a society are just unable to handle the onslaught we see of disinformation, unfounded conspiracy theory. There's just so much out there. Kathleen Hall Jamieson is co-founder of FactCheck.org. Can we keep up, right? Fact-checking politicians is one thing. Fact-checking the internet is quite the other.
Well, one of the difficulties that the fact-checking community faces is that the fact checks are read by people who are not likely to have been exposed to the misinformation. Mm. And the people who are likely to have been exposed to the misinformation are unlikely to be reading the fact checks. Also, those who are most likely to be exposed to misinformation are in like-minded communities in which they're getting the misinformation reinforced on a regular basis, and they're not getting a corrective context, particularly on news subjects. They're not getting corrective context before they're exposed to the misinformation. And as a result, they don't have the access to the knowledge base that would let them be wary of the misinformation. There are many advantages to the social media environment, but one of the disadvantages is that we tend to create enclaves of like-minded individuals who share material uncritically with each other because they're already disposed to believe it. We're all disposed to be critical of things we tend to disagree with to start with and to be highly accepting of things we're predisposed already to believe. But when you put us in a like-minded community in which that tendency is reinforced, the likelihood that our views will become more extreme is increased, and the likelihood that we'll become even less critical is increased. So then when you're exposed to something which would correct the misinformation, you're far less likely to believe it. At the same time, these communities have spent a great deal of time explaining to the people within them why they shouldn't believe anything that comes from anybody from outside the community. Unfortunately, the fact checkers are from outside the community. So is it difficult to penetrate those enclaves with corrective information? Yes. What is a solution? Get into those communities and start providing the counter information inside the communities to the extent possible.
So, you know, I guess another central question here is, like, is this a private company's, like Facebook's problem, right? Like, I can call my friends up and tell them disinformation. We wouldn't blame the phone company, or we wouldn't ask it to police what I say. Why is it different here with Facebook?
When you're calling your friends inside of a phone conversation, you are likely to be reaching people one-on-one. You're likely to have people you already knew and had physical contact outside, or they're inside a family network that's already established. The scope and scale of the networking inside social media means that your friendship linkage structure now includes people in the past you would have called strangers. You never would have actually met them. And so you're able to get more social signals from more people who are like you that you never would have been able to find before and put inside your social network. When you see something widely liked and shared, that signal of itself creates social pressure on you to believe and accept. When you share, you're putting your reputation as an individual behind the sharing. And so if that's material, for example, that comes from a pernicious source, your friend, and a friend now in quotation marks, broadly construed, now sees it as coming from you and your credibility is attached to it. So the capacity for others to influence the friend you're talking to on the phone didn't exist when you were talking on the phone. But now others who can influence you can influence them because you may uncritically share. And those are differences.
Let's look ahead a little bit to the 2020 election that's happening in less than 3 months here. There was a report released this summer by civil rights auditors warning that Facebook's failure to rein in toxic speech, racism, and misinformation could have serious repercussions on the election and may suppress voter turnout. The report took particular exemption with the company's decision not to take down some inflammatory rhetoric and false claims from President Trump. What are we in for the next few months leading into the election? Joshua, why don't you take that one first?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's nothing that leads us to think that we're in for, you know, things getting better in this regard, right? We're in a extremely, you know, one of the most highly polarized, certainly since in the post-World War II era, highly polarized environments that we've had in this country in a long time. And we now have all of these different tools that are out there for people to try to use social media to spread information, but also to play into this context of polarization. So I think the idea that we're going to see, you know, less toxic rhetoric online as we head into the election is probably, you know, wishful thinking, and this is going to continue. But I think we also have to be aware of the other ways in which social media is going to be used that may be more directly threatening to the integrity of the elections. One of the things we learned from 2016 from the Russian foreign influence campaigns is that they were both trying to help one candidate at the expense of the other, but also trying to cast a doubt on the overall integrity of the democratic system and the electoral process. Now, that fits very nicely with Russia's goals. If you're trying to push an authoritarian system on your own population and on your allies globally, showing that democracy doesn't really work and that it doesn't work the way it claimed to do, that pushes Russians goals very nicely. But if you think about in the context of the coming election, if you have one side that is losing the election, casting doubt upon the integrity of that process is a viable strategy for contesting that kind of a contested situation. And we are heading into this election in completely uncharted territory around the way in which people are going to be voting. And that's because of the COVID-19 pandemic. So you combine all of those things, this existing toolkit that we have from 2016, and you combine that with the fact that you're going to have tons of people voting by mail. You're going to have election results possibly or probably not available on election night in a way that people are anticipating. So I think what we have to be thinking about now is there's going to be these kinds of coordinated campaigns where you are going to be having attacks on the integrity of the political process. And a lot of that is going to revolve around the vote by mail. And we're already seeing this. And this is where it gets, looping back to where we started the conversation, this is where it gets particularly complicated, because it's one thing to be able to say this is, you know, foreign disinformation, Facebook can take down a foreign electoral campaign. It's another thing to say, like, this is from a junk news source. This is not really a newspaper. This is not really a reporter. They haven't done anything. It's still a third thing entirely when you have the president of the United States reiterating claims that are blatantly false, that you have, you know, different levels of fraud based on different ways of voting in the election. So I think this is what this is going to be the big story in it. You will both have the continued toxicity, and but you will also have these specific kind of themes of misinformation that are being circulated in an effort to cast doubt on the electoral process. And that's only going to accentuate, I think, on election day and election night. If we don't have an answer to who's won the election on that night,
right,
you're going to see this on steroids in the week after that.
Kathleen Hall Jamison, you've written extensively about 2016 and studied it. When you're looking forward to what's going to happen in the next few months here, what are you wary of?
I'm concerned about direct forms of intervention in which, for example, you might have a scenario where part of the electric grid is taken down and nobody is voting through electronic means and that place is able to vote at all. I'm concerned about the possibility that you get hackers who come into our electoral infrastructure and simply delete, you know, the every tenth name or every name that sounds as if it's identified with a certain race or ethnicity, or alternatively mismatches the registration data with what you have to verify the election integrity. So we know that it penetrating the electoral infrastructure occurred in 2016. We know that there are efforts to do that that are ongoing now. We know that our secretaries of state have been engaging in a great deal of activity trying to minimize the likelihood that would happen. And as people talk about mail-in voting, I want to make a really important point. A mail-in ballot is actually less subject to manipulation than is an electronic voting machine. I mean, when I vote in Philadelphia and I use an electronic machine, any form of malware can intercept that before that the vote is actually tallied. And until we move to paper backup, I couldn't verify that I had a given vote. At least when I put my ballot in the mail, my signature is on it. I can take a picture of it with my cell phone. And if the state tells me it's arrived, I've now got a form of certification I didn't have under electronic voting. So as we talk about mail-in balloting, Let's hope that the post office works well. Those heroic individuals who've been bringing us food and bringing us our mail for the last, you know, for the last period during the pandemic deserve a special amount of gratitude and praise. Let's make sure that that system is working well. If it is, it actually safeguards against certain forms of electoral manipulation.
Hmm. I just wanted to mention a comment we got from a listener, Mike, who says, I wonder who fact checks the fact checkers. I think it's hard for people to separate their opinions from the facts. And his point seems to kind of get into this idea that, like, a lot of people have lost trust in institutions in general. And it seems like, you know, even an organization and an esteemed one for a long time, Kathleen, with factcheck.org, people call into question, you know, who fact checks you?
Yeah, there's been an ongoing attack on the whole fact-checking structure, which identifies with one ideology or another, basically depending on whomever you're fact-checking. It's usually the other side that's complaining. Everybody ought to be accountable for their work. Here's what we do at factcheck.org. To try to minimize the likelihood that we're only seeing things that we disagree with. Remember, we're more likely to be critical of things we disagree with, hence not see the things our own side does that are incorrect. We check every claim in every presidential debate. We check every ad. That minimizes that kind of selection bias. We have an editorial process in which people read and reread against each other's fact checks in order to try to make sure that if any inadvertent biases come in, we catch it. We cite to the sources we're using to adjudicate claims, so you can go read those sources to see whether you think we're correct or not. And if you disagree with us and you make a cogent argument, we will not only respond to it, we will post that argument up online in our response. Those are always we try to increase our accountability about what we do, because humans do have biases, and we need to do everything we can to counteract them by putting in norms of transparency and processes that minimize the likelihood that we will act on them.
Mm. We've been talking a lot about the role of the companies and what they should be doing. I'm wondering if, you know, there's just a need for a massive rethinking of how families and schools teach kids and prepare them to be critical thinkers and savvy audiences so that they can sort all this stuff out as it exponentially grows in the next few decades. Joshua?
Yeah, so I'm all in favor of training our kids to be digitally literate and for them to think about how information is being transmitted to them in the modern age. I do feel a compulsion, though, to mention earlier research we did on the 2016 elections, where we looked at who had shared links to false news, or as Professor Jameson likes to call them, imposter news sites. So news sites that were not real news sites, but they were sharing false news during the 2016 election. We looked at who had shared links to these sites on Facebook. And what we found was that people over the age of 65 in our sample, on average, were sharing 7 times as many links to these sites as were 18 to 29-year-olds. And the relationship went up as you went from younger people to older people. So absolutely, I think we want to think about how we are training students in schools today. I think we want to think about how we're educating them. But if we think that that's going to solve the issue of who's sharing and circulating misinformation during the course on social media, we have to think much more broadly than this. And I think we have to think about other populations that are involved in this. And I think we need to think more holistically in that regard.
Mm. Well, Kathleen Hull Jameson, I'll give the last word to you.
Those are concerned particularly about shaping the ways in which the young, as they enter the electorate, process information, go find news feed defenders. It's on the Annenberg Classroom website of the Annenberg Public Policy Center. It's also on Justice O'Connor's iCivic site. We partnered with them in order to create it. It helps people in high schools learn how to curate their own site to standards of accuracy, to standards of fidelity with what is factual.
Well, we've been having this conversation this hour with Kathleen Hull Jameson, a communications professor at the University of Pennsylvania and the co-founder of factcheck.org. Also, we've had Joshua Tucker, co-director of NYU's Center for Social Media and Politics. Earlier in the hour, we heard from David Dayan, executive editor of The American Prospect. Our engineer today was Diana Martinez. Radio Times is produced by John Ahrens, Debbie Bilder, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Kevin McCrory, in for Marty Moskowitz. Thanks for joining us today. We're going to have a wonderful conversation tomorrow about, a tough conversation tomorrow about gun violence in the city of Philadelphia, what we're doing about it. We're going to hear from community leaders and health experts. experts and try to dive into this conversation where, unfortunately, you know, too many kids and adults have been caught in this situation that is very difficult. Hope you can tune in for that one. Thanks so much again. You've been listening to Radio Times.